This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it's Meera Sivisuthi. Welcome to the show. Of the 140 listed languages in Malaysia, 2 are extinct, 11 are institutional, 19 are developing, 10 are vigorous, 86 are in trouble, and 12 are dying. How do we preserve minority languages while fostering national identity? Well, in the studio with me, Professor Derek Irwin, who is head of School of English at a private university. Welcome to the show, Professor. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, Meera. Thank you.
You know, you're coming from Canada. You've done a lot of research focused on Canadian Aboriginal or, you know, First Nation communities. Would you like to share that research with me, and how did it actually pan out for you?
Oh, absolutely. I should make a minor correction, though. My focus of research was not exactly in the First Nations languages themselves, but rather how English was used to bring in aspects of those languages and cultures. So how early settlers and explorers in Canada made use of Aboriginal languages within English, and then how later on those same resources were used in a nation-building exercise, mm-hmm. more or less.
I mean, I'm trying to get my head around that. I mean, Aborigines are normally people, as we call them, Bumiputras, you know, people mm-hmm. of the soil. They're from there before anyone else came. So how does English sort of draw out Aboriginal language?
Well,
I would have thought it would have been the other way around.
Yes and no. There is an awful lot of influence the other way, obviously. But being a scholar of English, my focus was when these words came into our language. Very simply, there are different ways that you can theorize why these words came into English. One way you could look at it is a slot and filler analogy. So I'm an explorer in a new country. I've come to a strange place. I see strange things. What do I call them? German has a very good resource, which is compounding. So you just bring whatever you want in, stick the things together, you end up with enormous words that are very descriptive and very Germanic in origin.
Okay.
English is a borrower. We bring in words from all over the place. In the North American situation, the Jamestown colony in the U.S., for example, people would see a skunk. And you could call it a stinky cat if you wanted to. But another thing that you can do is find out what the native peoples call it and use that word. Okay, so if you believe that language at its kind of essence is experiential, so that what we're trying to do is reflect the real world around us, and that's solely what we're doing, then that slot filler analogy works very well. If, as I do, you think that we use language for other purposes, one of which, very important one, is the interpersonal, then there are other interesting questions to ask about why people would do this. So why use a foreign word when you could very well use a regular word from your language? A good example from Canadian English is the word toboggan. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know what a toboggan is.
No.
So you wouldn't know, but you would know that the phonology of toboggan is somehow not Anglo-Saxon, that there's something a little bit strange about it. And so then I would have to explain to you what a toboggan is. And that would make my language a little bit more foreign and therefore distinct from yours in some way. So this again comes back to that crux of language, culture, and identity. I'm identifying myself as using certain lexical items that you wouldn't necessarily know. Incidentally, a toboggan is a kind of sled.
Okay.
So it's a flat sled mm-hmm. With a curve in the front.
And it sounds like a percussion instrument.
If you go fast enough down a hill on it, it does turn into a percussion instrument. And in fact, the Canadian literature talking about toboggan uses it as a kind of rite of passage. It was the originator of a kind of extreme sport. So you would build these gigantic ice slides down big hills. Montreal in Montreal was one of them. But there was actually a Canadian budgetary line in the Canadian national budget, which was for the maintenance of toboggan hills in certain areas. And these were basically for young people to jump on these things, slide down, and, you know, in the kind of Victorian area, be able to grab one another. And it was a horror movie for the early days. Right?
Is it a very native language, toboggan? Did it come from
it is.
The
it's
natives?
From Algonquian. Now, what's interesting in Canada, of course, is that you have these words that come through both English and French. And so there's another loan word, muskellunge, which is kind of fish. So there's no reason why you couldn't use sled for toboggan, mm-hmm. right? It's a particular type of sled, but you could certainly use that word to describe it. But instead, choosing to use toboggan identifies you immediately as Canadian, essentially, because we all know what it is. Even though we no longer use the instrument of a toboggan, the wooden sled that I described, even if people are on these plastic things, they still say they're tobogganing, mm-hmm. for example. A muskellunge is a kind of fish, and it's a pike, right? A relative of the pike. Much larger, more dangerous, and, you know, imbues those qualities that we very often talk about the native having. So, Terry Goldie is a literary scholar who's looked at Australian, New Zealand, and Canadian Aboriginal figures in early literature. And he named his book Fear and Temptation because he argued that, in fact, the image of the indigene in these literatures embodied both the fear of the unknown, and so the frightening image of the savage, let's say. And I use these words very guardedly. I'm not arguing that these peoples are like that, but in the literature it would. And then, of course, we all know the Pocahontas figure, right? So the beautiful tribal princess, the object of desire. So you have this fear and temptation. And so we are to feel this way about the image of the indigene. My argument is that we imbue the very language with that. So when we are using these items, they are similarly culturally shaded. That, in fact, this crux of language, culture, and identity is in some ways inescapable because we're using the words very deliberately to associate, not just amongst ourselves as a nation, but with the indigenous peoples in a way that we borrowed these from. Mm-hmm. So to take an example of how we do this that's non-linguistic, if you go into any store, free, duty-free store in Canada, or any souvenir shop, I'm not sure if you've managed to get there, but...
No, I haven't.
You will see your maple syrup.
Okay.
You will see your hockey paraphernalia, of course. But what you'll also see are things like totem poles. So the West Coast giant trees that are carved, right? Now, these don't belong throughout Canada. They're very specifically a West Coast phenomenon of particular tribes there. You'll also see dream catchers. Now, dream catchers, I've seen here, in fact. Mm-hmm. They're for sale over at the Curve the last time I checked. On the street, there are people okay. who sell dream catchers. And now, these are a particularly... Ojibwe-Cree phenomenon. So they don't belong to the same groups that would do the totem poles. And then you can get Inukshuk. So do you remember the Vancouver Olympics?
Yes.
So you remember the Canadian symbol of the Olympics, mm-hmm. which is a rock pile that's designed to look human. Mm-hmm. Now, these are the wardens of the North. The Inukshuk is particularly taken from the Inuit, who are the northernmost, what we used to call Eskimo, and in other places are called Eskimo. So we've borrowed all of these symbols and kind of pushed them together into this amalgam of nativeness, and then present them as if these are somehow symbolic of Canada. And we're not alone in this,
obviously. I think every country does that, really.
Every country...
We
who
do
has
that.
The indigenous peoples to borrow from.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. The handicraft phenomenon. We have soapstone carving. Go to Australia, what do you find? You get your boomerangs, you get your didgeridoo. So this is the ways that we borrow indigeneity as a majority culture, and we bring it in order to identify ourselves. So, you know, you can tell the difference between all of these nation states who use English, for example, because we can point to certain forms of identification, one of which is a form of indigenous culture.
And all of this, has it got to do purely with tourism?
Purely with...
Well, in my mind, you know, I have a bane to pick with capitalism and, you know, it's just commercialization, isn't it?
Yes, and in fact, that's a really interesting point when you're talking about language, because you know, we're using fundamentally mercantile terms, aren't we, when we talk about loan words or we talk about borrowing terms. These are mercantile metaphors, and yet it doesn't work because you don't have an exhaustible resource. I mean, language is not the type of thing that I can lend you, right? You can learn some and use it yourself. So, but what's really interesting about that as a metaphor is it also indicates a kind of debt, doesn't it? So if I have borrowed a word, then at some point, assumedly, I have to give something back for it. Mm-hmm. But that's where we're falling short with the indigenous communities that we deal with, is, you know, we borrow in that capacity, but we do have not only a cultural debt then, but we also have to look at if... Basically, the fundamental hypocrisy is if we're going to identify ourselves via these forms of indigeneity, then how can we have these communities that exist as sub-communities within our own cultures and who are, by all measures of quality of life, life expectancy, access to education, all of these measures are simply not doing as well as the rest of the population.
Mm-hmm. And are you saying then, you know, the fact that we don't really have much, you know, regard for these communities, which, you know, most countries have issues with Aboriginal, you know, interests, doesn't seem to be a priority amongst many countries.
Oh, empirically, we can prove that it's not a priority with the major countries that deal with it. In 2007, the UN had a declaration on the rights of indigenous people, and it was voted for by 144 countries and against by Australia, Canada, US, and New Zealand. So these obviously are four countries which have very strong interest in notions of indigeneity. And I think it's fair to say so does Malaysia. There's a very very difficult situation here in the sense of what you define as indigenous. The first peoples in several cases are themselves Malaic. So a lot of the languages would share a common root. But there are obviously huge cultural differences. Jeffrey Benjamin writes very well on the notions of the difference between indigenousness and indigeny. Okay, and indigeny is the sense of belonging to a place and a kind of family unit. So, you know, people who are born here in Malaysia, and this isn't just obviously an issue of the First Nations groups or the Malay people, or I mean, it's an issue of anyone who is born in a place to a family who is of that place. You feel a connection to it. That's not the same as what we seem to mean when we're talking about indigenousness. And the notion of indigenousness is more along the lines of conflating with certain types of tribality. Benjamin does a really beautiful job, actually, of arguing about the Malay or the Malaysian situation, let's say, where tribality is actually to be distinguished from these other things as well, because it's a political system in which the peoples organizing themselves along tribal lines are doing so in resistance to the hierarchical social structures that would otherwise be imposed upon them. You can make parallels with that and the North American situation to a degree, but the historical situations are quite different. In really, really broad strokes, you can say, okay, all of these countries that are dealing with indigeneity are doing so both as colonizers and colonized. And it, you know, it depends on which group you're going to affiliate yourself with as to whether you believe that the dominant society is itself the colonizer or has been colonized. I mean, obviously, these things exist in a flux everywhere, but they're even more complex when you have these subgroups that have been there first. The Canadian situation in particular, you know, when you enter a country and there are groups of people there, and let's face it, you want their land, what do you do? You know, and some places would have right of conquest. So the repulsive, repugnant, and most effective way is genocide. And not, I'm obviously not calling for that. That's,
Yeah.
However, that is a simpler solution, as we have seen in other historical cases. So from a native point of view, the U.S. would have been guilty of actual genocide in several cases. Canadian history is been accused of being culturally genocidal, but probably less so physically. It was much more a coercive effort. So instead of wiping out a tribe, you would get them to sign pieces of paper, which would then give you their land. And then you would draw an arbitrary boundary and say, okay, here you go, you live here now. And then if you wanted that land, you would say, no, I didn't mean there, I meant over there, so move again. And this is more the history of that area. But, oh, sorry, did you want to?
That's okay. So that's pretty much the situation in Canada and in Malaysia. When we come back, I want to find out a little bit more about, if you can give me examples. I mean, you've done work in Sabah and Sarawak?
I haven't yet, no. I'm very excited to.
Okay. So then we'll see, you know, what you plan to actually do. And, you know, based on your expertise and, you know, your experience, what are you planning to do in Sabah and Sarawak? And what is your take on Malaysia at the moment? And I want you to just give me a little bit more specifics. And what's come to mind now is, what is really native? Is really what's, after everything that you've said, what is native? We'll come back and find out up next. If you have a question for Derek, send it through. The number is 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture, and with me, Derek Irwin, Head of School of English at a private university. We're discussing preserving minority languages. Now, this is really interesting, Derek, based on what you've done in Canada, and you're here in Malaysia now. You know, in Canada, you actually have an Aboriginal Affairs Ministry. Do you think that's something that's necessary, you know, in every country who have or prioritize Aborigines and tribal groups?
That is a kind of loaded question, simply because of the ambivalent nature of some of these organizations towards what their actual goal might be. The official name of the Aboriginal Affairs Ministry is the Ministry of Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development. And I think it's kind of important to keep in mind the second part of that. So they very much see themselves as having this dual role. Now, Northern Development can have two very, very different implications. So you could be doing human resource development, mm-hmm. which is the type of thing that we were talking about in terms of education and assistance for remote communities, let's say. Or you could be in charge of oil licensing and other things that are okay. part of the physical development of the resources of those areas, in which case those can be sometimes diametrically opposed remits. Okay, so similarly, in fact, there is here in Malaysia the JOKOA or JOKOA, yep. and that is particularly for Orang Asli affairs, as far as I can tell.
The Jabatan Kemajuan Orang Asli.
Correct, mm-hmm. yes. Now, this is also underneath the, which is it, the Ministry of Rural Development. So we have the same type of notions going on. Now, I'm not judging either one of those particular ministries or any. Obviously, these exist to do what they can to help these communities. But given a dual role in the notion of development, that can sometimes be an extraordinarily tricky concept if what you're trying to do is preserve cultures. So if I wish to develop a people or assist a people to develop, how do I go about it? The early days of the Canadian experience involved taking young people away from their families, putting them in residential religious schools, and abusing them. I mean, making sure that they did not have the connection with their language. And this was done let's give the benefit of the doubt. It was done in order to help to assimilate those children into the greater society. Other programs were to take Native children away from their parents and have them adopted by people within usually urban centers. Okay, so there's a massive disruption to their culture. So we have to ask ourselves what we mean by development, what we mean by helping people. And as I spoke before, when we talk about the notion of language, culture, and identity, a lot of the problem here is with how we define identity and who is defining it, how we define culture and who is defining it or imposing it on the other. Which culture you want to speak about? And there are arguments. Some people would say that, in fact, ridding ourselves of a form of indigeneity is actually valuable because, you know, it's because of the conditions in very remote places that lead to disease, that lead to injuries, that, you know, if you read some of the early, I guess, anthropological work that took place even here in Malaysia, you see some very interesting accounts of, you know, people who saw other people die from falling out of trees and things like that. And that happens less when you're in urban settings, not only because we have less trees, mm-hmm. but because you can get to a hospital more quickly and things like that. So, you know, access to healthcare is easy if you're not remote, but it's also easy if you speak the language and you understand what's going on when you get to the hospital and you have the resources and the bank accounts and all these other things. So if that's what we mean by development, then the major hurdle to development is going to be whether we respect these communities' abilities to define what they want to be. In anthropological linguistics, what we would be interested in is going into these communities in order to both record the languages and learn about them. From my particular tradition of systemic functional linguistics, this includes early work by people like Bronislaw Malinowski, who came up with the idea of context of culture when he was looking at the Torbrian Islanders in the South Pacific, because certain forms of language can only be understood if you understand the culture from which they arise. So I think this is true of all languages, incidentally. Yeah. Most of us are multilingual, and Malaysia is enormously multilingual. How can you understand some other group of people unless you understand how they go about expressing?
Well, my question is, should they assimilate? You know, why don't we just leave them to be, which is what makes them most happy, I think. We seem to feel that, as you said, this whole notion of development, what is it really? Mm-hmm. In their minds, our idea of development is not their idea of development. And bringing
them up.
Well,
I'm not going to speak for them. And this
no,
is, I think, is important.
I have spoken to them. I have had the Orang Aslis in, and they're very happy where they are. We seem to think that in order for them to be developed, we need to bring them out into the cities and, you know, get them assimilated here. But they're quite happy where they are.
Let me just make 2 points, if I may. The first is to make generalities about Orang Asli is very interesting, because that blanket term comprises, you know, according to official numbers, at least 20 different groups and possibly more. According to anthropologists who've studied these groups and linguists and other people, they have wildly varying social structures, habits, beliefs. So to say, and I'm not trying, this is very common, and I'll explain why as well. In North America, this is exceedingly common. But to say that the Orang Asli want this or want that may be true of A, any individual, B, any group, but it is unlikely to be true of the whole. Only because they comprise many, many different groups. So in North America, the situation being analogous anyway, you have the idea of the First Nations or whatever group name you want to give. A better term in some ways is the term Indian, which is highly offensive in the Canadian context anyway. It's still often used in the U.S. But the reason why that can be a useful word is if you know what you mean by it. So Daniel Francis wrote a really interesting book called The Imaginary Indian. And in that, what he was saying is the idea of the Indian or pan-Indian identity only exists in relation to the colonizer. So there is no group of native peoples that have a single identity until I step in and give them something to identify against.
Okay.
No.
Not with.
Probably not with.
Against.
Because you're coming in and saying, okay, you should speak this language. And it doesn't matter. In Canada, let's say you've got at least 180 different language groups, just on the West Coast, potentially. So you look at those enormous numbers of different languages. The only thing that's consistent is the English, let's say, that you're trying to make them speak, or the Malay that you think that everyone should speak, or the French in certain areas that they should all speak. The other thing that's consistent is you, I guess, want their land, and they don't really want to give it to you. So that gives them a nice pan identity as well. So they, you know, but it's all structured around the person or persons, rather, that they're reacting against. So it's our movement into the territory that creates the image of the indigene. So I mentioned Terry Goldie's book, Fear and Temptation, before. And he also is very, very careful in that book to say, I'm not looking at these images of the indigene to learn anything about the groups that are being represented. Because it's not the groups representing themselves. The image in these books is the one that's being constructed by the dominant culture. So we're learning about our culture. So when I'm studying the loan words in English, I'm not learning about the cultures that contributed these loan words. Peripherally I am, because I'm very interested in them. I'm fascinated to study Ojibwe, for example. It's a marvelous language. There's so much rich culture there, and it is very interesting. But that's not what I'm learning about when I look at English. I'm learning about the people who used English, right? So that's something to keep in mind. Now, once you have that as a kind of baseline and you say, okay, it's the groups themselves that should be known in the plural, then I would say you need to empower those groups to make their own decisions. So some...
Keyword being empower.
Well, I think so, because...
And in order to empower, you need to speak the language. You need to understand the culture.
It is not really possible to interact unless we have a communicative system to do so. Now, which communicative system is a very interesting question, isn't it? So, you know, there's no problem with quite a number of groups here because they will speak some form of Malayic language. But then once you get up into the northern reaches, they're more Khmer languages. So you've got closer to Thai descent and things like that. So they're mutually unintelligible to Malay. And then once you get out into Borneo, for example, you're talking about a huge number of different languages which may or may not be intelligible to also... I mean, one of the benefits here is that a lot of the groups, at least according to Jeffrey Benjamin and what he said, is a great number of the groups have people who are bilingual in whatever their language is and Malay. So there is the possibility to interact.
So not impossible, then.
I don't think so.
Can be done. And I will have you back after you go to Sabah and Sarawak, for sure. I want to find out how you've done this.
I'm a firm believer, obviously, in education. I'm an educator. I think what we should be doing is, as much as possible, being able to go into groups and giving them the tools that are needed in order to determine what they believe the development should be. And you know, we should respect the fact if they simply don't want to be part of that. I don't consider that a problem, really.
Up next, will culture die when language dies? Coming up on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasuthi. We're discussing preserving minority languages with Derek Owen, Head of School of English at a private university here. I mean, very interesting, Derek. I mean, I really don't feel like talking while you're talking, actually.
I apologize.
Enlightening, honestly. It is enlightening. I wish I had a whole load more time so that we can go further into it. But do you think, I mean, I've had people on the show who talk about when language dies, so will the culture. Do you think that will be the case? Or that will really happen?
I think that's a question that depends in large part about how you're defining your terms again. I apologize for being such a linguist, but you know, many of these are in some ways semantic questions. Now, there is a traditional means of viewing this question in the North American context, which has to do with what's called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. These are two people who were actually experts on native languages in North America. And what they argued in its extreme version is that language determines thought. In its more mild version, you could argue that language influences thought. So in some languages, there are simply some thoughts which cannot be constructed because there's not necessarily the vocabulary or means to do so. Alternately, the ways that we do have a language can influence the way that we construct certain framing and looking at situations. Now, the prototypical example is something like Inuktitut, which Sapir was talking about in terms of having many, many words for snow. I think the number he gave was 76. And obviously there's not 76 words for snow in English. But then it depends how you're going to define a word. I mean, this is what linguists get into, right? So, you know, in a number of different polysynthetic languages, you have the capacity to put a whole lot into a single word. But if I say, you know, we have wet snow, am I using two words or am I using a word to describe a certain type of snow? And so then you get into these type of problems. Now, this is because, obviously, if I'm in an environment, say Canada, with a lot of snow, I'm going to be extremely interested in knowing what kind of snow there is out there, whether I speak Inuktitut or English or French or whatever language we're dealing in. I want to know if I walk outside whether I'm going to be dead by the time I hit 5 feet or, you know, these are important questions. Yeah. That being said, so language is flexible, I think is my point in that. But also, languages are absolutely incredible in the sense that they are our one way to see into the human brain. Let me go back just slightly. We do have equipment that will allow us to see things like electrical or magnetic imagery in the brain. So we can see activation centers and things
with fMRIs.
Like exactly, mm-hmm. or EEGs or things like that. And there are people doing absolutely marvelous work in linguistics and things like that. But at present, these are still fairly crude. So we can't see very precise where things are operating. Certainly, our resolution isn't all that great on these type of things. What is, however, readily available to us is people's language. So how people construct that environment, interpersonal interface between their computational apparatus and the rest of the world, including other people, right? So if someone has a language that is slightly different than other languages, that tells us something very, very important about base human capacity. So if there's a language that can do a certain thing in a certain way, that tells us that the human brain is capable of doing something very different than we could have assumed that it has done. And we don't have the data to be able to say that's the case or not unless we have investigated the language and we know how things are done. Now, that's a purely kind of selfish linguistic point of view, but it's also an important humanistic point of view, so knowing what kind of capacities we have. On a more, even more humanistic level, let's talk about it in terms of verbal art, right? What are we capable of in terms of this expression plane? What do we bring into the language that will enable us to express or see the beauty in the world? How do cultures interact in terms of their mating rituals and songs and all these other semiotic activities? When a language dies, all of those expression planes die with it. So we're left with essentially a hole in human knowledge, which doesn't have to be there if we make the effort to go and make sure that not only we're recording these, and that, because that's very selfish to just go out and record these languages, but to go and actually assist the communities to do language description work, which can then feed back into their own educational capacity. So, you know, with people who are properly trained to do so, you can create language-sustaining materials. And these can be held by the community. In fact, best case scenario, they are done by people who are properly trained in that community in order to maintain whatever that community feels is going to be important for its own future.
With people moving around, you know, the globe, really, do you think it'll even matter in time to come?
We can't see the future in the sense that whether we'll keep globalized. I mean,
I'm using myself as an example. You know, grandparents came from Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. I don't speak the language. Mm-hmm. I'm very Malaysian in my way, right? So, hence, my children don't speak the language. It's probably going to die.
One of the common refrains that I've heard from the people that I've met here in Malaysia is, I wish my parents taught me my mother tongue.
Yes.
And this is something that we may have to have a sea shift in the way that we perceive language. You are not, I will argue again selfishly as a linguist, you are not denying your children opportunity by ensuring that they speak more than one language. Okay? Just because you want them to be extraordinarily proficient in Malay or in English doesn't mean that they cannot still operate in other languages. It may delay the onset of other languages slightly, but the benefits of having multilingual children are not just in a communicative capacity. I would argue that, in fact, you would have a lot of different cognitive skills by being able to be multilingual. So that's my plea.
You're just trying to console me, aren't you? But, you know, with, as I said, with people moving around the world, we all pick up one language and or two languages. And
it depends how you define language, though. Because, you know, what is English? Is English an amalgam of all of these many, many different loanwords in it? We can bring in other. Where are the boundaries to English? Right? Does the I'm Canadian, so I want to end every sentence with A, right?
And I will end every sentence with la. Yeah.
So the two of us have two different versions of English, let's say, or do we both speak English? I mean, there are two major forces when you're talking about language, and these are convergence, because we all want to be able to speak to one another. Humans are remarkably gregarious when we're not killing each other. But as soon as you isolate communities, then you have divergence, because people are only talking amongst themselves, and we seem to have a flexibility of brain that leads us into different forms of expression. It wouldn't take very long for all of us living in separate villages to have a lot of different languages again.
Again. We have a question here. Does Canada have a repository or archive for all her languages? I mean, should this be initiated in Malaysia as well, in view of the many tongues going into extinction?
I think that's a marvelous idea. There are a few projects of this nature in vestigial form. So there isn't a massive project. I've heard linguists call. In fact, I was at the International Systemic Functional Congress this summer up in Guangzhou in China, and the call up there was for basically the equivalent of the Human Genome Project for languages, and that is building just such a repository of all the world's languages. Tricky, But I think that the difficulties of that could certainly be overcome if we use something like an IPA or International Phonetic Alphabet, or there has to be ways to encode it that we would be able to bring all of these languages. And then what an incredible resource for being able to analyze the abilities of human expression and just what reaches we can attain, basically.
I mean, you're so passionate about what you do, Derek. I mean, I'm just thinking, how many people like you exist to want to actually initiate or even go into more and more research like this?
There are quite a number of people who are doing these types of research.
And then the question is, you know, does the research reach the masses?
That's where we are not very good. Linguists are not very good at speaking to people, ironically.
You do realize you do it very well.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Should just come out of the woods more.
It may be that I'm not much of a linguist, so I make up for it by, you know, hanging out with the common folk. No, I'm just joking. But anyone who's tried to study grammar, I'm a grammarian. That's my basic field of specialization. So anyone who tries to plumb their way through grammar is immediately alienated by all the jargon and everything else. But it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, we all language. That's what we do. We're human. That's one of the things that makes us human. And so we should all be able to talk about how we use language. And we should all be studying it. That's what our students do. I mean, we have Introduction to Linguistics, where students are encouraged to go out and collect their own language data and to look at how they use it, how their families do, how we interact all the time. We are always in this marvelous, what we would call semiotic environment, language rich. And it's not just language, it's other means of interaction. But, I think it is important for us to start to think about how we do it, certainly how we can do it effectively, mm-hmm. if possible, and the implications of what we're doing when we insist on people doing things certain ways and that type of thing.
I think I just posted on Facebook this afternoon. I was sitting having lunch with, and I was observing a group of 15 students mm-hmm. of a certain race with one person who was completely from a different race, obviously. Mm-hmm. And the 15 were going off in their own language, mm-hmm. and that one person was totally lost. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, where is the respect for the one person mm-hmm. who isn't quite speaking that language? And it just gets your mind thinking. I mean, it's respect versus being comfortable speaking your own language.
It's a very difficult balancing act, isn't it? You are looking at inclusion or exclusion, and language is one of the easiest ways to do that. There are some languages which have very deliberately a secret language. So some of the tribes that I've studied in North America, they would have a language which was mutually intelligible with other groups in their area, but they would also have a secret language only spoken amongst themselves so that no one else could do this. Now, that's an extremely good negotiation tactic, if you have a means of speaking that no one else can use. Mm. But it's not so good in a food court, perhaps.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
You know, how would you conclude, Derek?
I would conclude by saying that I think it is very important to look at notions of indigeneity and how we go about constructing the image within our own cultures. Your basic line of respect, I think, is very important as a closing note. We need to make sure that when we are doing work in remote communities of any sort, that we do respect the fact that these are peoples who are fully capable, decision-making, you know, groups. So we should not be imposing what we think is right on them, but rather assisting in developing capacity to either interact or build up infrastructure or whatever is determined by those groups that's what's needed.
Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me. It was very kind.
Derek Irwin, Head of School of English at a private university on preserving minority languages on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.